We are with Denis Roncourt to talk about a text that he wrote called Against Diversity of Tactics in Support of Direct Action. Could you speak about the context when you wrote this text?
Well, I wrote this article very recently, and it's something that I've always been concerned with, the arguments for diversity of tactics, you know. When I first heard about it many years ago in a documentary film about anti-globalization struggles, the concept was explained by one of the activist organizers of one of the groups. I believe she was an anarchist. And it made a lot of sense to me. And in fact, I received it very positively. But then with experience and talking to more activists throughout the years and so on, I came to understand that it's really primarily a way for the more anarchist activists to try and get the mainstream sort of more progressive liberal anarchists or activists rather to protect them, to be on side, to at least not attack them, to not make their work more difficult. It's a way of trying to convince the progressives that the work that the Black Bloc and other anarchists are doing is helpful to the struggle and to get them to appreciate that and, if possible, provide protection in terms of recognizing that the higher risk they take is useful and in terms of supporting them either with jail solidarity afterwards or in the comments they make to the media or to explaining what is happening to other activists. I came to understand it mainly as a rationale for trying to coordinate with progressives and trying to get a collaboration with progressives. Now, that in itself doesn't sound like a bad idea, but then I also, in parallel, came to understand that progressives are basically part of the problem. In other words, that the mainstream activists that show up and that are intent on so-called nonviolent or pacifist tactics only are actually part of the problem. And this relates to my reading of Ward Churchill, who wrote the essay entitled Pacifism as Pathology, to explain the main problem that we have in North American mainstream activism. So when you come to understand the progressives as being individuals who are avoiding risk, who are avoiding effective methods, and who are mainly after guilt alleviation, and who are basically trying to feel good about themselves by doing a kind of weekend activism to express their opinion, when you come to understand that progressives believe a false model of how societal change occurs. They believe that their opinion is going to matter to power. They actually have that as a fundamental belief of how they are acting in society. So when you come to understand progressives, what they believe, what they're about, and why they insist on nonviolence, and you come to understand that nonviolence actually protects the state, and now I'm referring to a book by Peter Gelderloos, I believe it's entitled How Nonviolence Protects the State, which was written, I think, largely inspired by Ward Churchill's work. When you come to understand what progressives are about, basically, then I came to the conclusion that we should not try to collaborate with progressives, that they're collaborators with the enemy. And I think we have to see the hierarchical system. As anarchists, we have to see the hierarchical system as the enemy, as the root cause of all our problems. Because this hierarchy takes away our individual influence, our agency, the possibility for our contributions to community and to the public and political life of our communities and larger organizations. So when you come to understand, as anarchists do, that hierarchy is the problem, and you come to understand that progressives support this hierarchy and only want to make it better, you understand that what progressives do, in fact, strengthens the very system that is the root cause of all of these social injustices, both locally in our communities and around the world as capitalist expansion around the world through corporatism and so on. So it just became clear to me that this diversity of tactics as a way of collaborating with collaborators is a bad idea. And in fact, what we should be doing instead is putting the pressure on these progressives who are collaborators so that they at least have a chance of understanding that they're on the wrong side of the battle in terms of justice and in terms of the root causes of these problems. So I think that as activists who come to understand this, if we're serious about wanting to create more justice and wanting to flatten this hierarchical pyramid, then we need to confront these pacifists and progressives, and we need to actually try to have an influence on them by making them aware of our position, making them aware that we, by exposing them basically, by exposing them for the collaborators that they are, and forget about putting energy into this so-called diversity of tactics when it involves trying to convince them that we're okay and that we're all on the same side. I believe that fundamentally we're not on the same side. I believe there's a division between, you know, direct action anarchists who understand that you actually have to physically resist with your bodies, with your voice. You have to put yourself at risk. You have to, that confrontation is necessary. There's those who understand that and who are willing to do it. And then there's those who are all about believing, supporting, sustaining, and improving the hierarchical system, which can only create these injustices. So once you understand that, you have to come to the conclusion that this whole idea of diversity of tactics is a waste of energy, it's a bad idea, and it's counterproductive.
Yeah, but what you will say to anarchists saying that we're already very isolated, so if we begin to be too much critic about those people, we'll isolate ourselves more.
You are isolated in any case. It doesn't break your isolation to comply or to collaborate with the enemy. That does not break your isolation. Solidarity can only be between people who are on the same side and who are fighting and taking a similar risk. That is the meaning of solidarity. So if you want to join mainstream society, the system, and so on, then by all means do that. But by doing that, you will not, in fact, I believe you'll only increase your isolation because it'll become more evident. The more you interact with these people, the more you realize that there is a fundamental difference in philosophy, in position, in beliefs that cannot be fixed or seen to be compatible. And therefore, the only way is to create discomfort, create some confrontations, try to create ways that at least some of them will come to understand you and will join you. But that is the nature of revolutionary act. I mean, the great majority of activists in North America are pacifists in the sense of Ward Churchill and therefore are part of the problem. So the idea is not to join them. The idea is not to try to collaborate with them. And you cannot educate them with arguments and with words. So I think you have to use pressure. And that means societal pressure. That means exposing them. That means depending on psychological mechanisms such as image, self-image, pressuring, creating discomfort. The revolutionary methods of the 60s, basically, when young revolutionaries tried to create a consciousness by using these kinds of methods, by disturbing. I think those are the only methods we can use against collaborators. I think it has to become clear in our minds that the majority of so-called activists are collaborators, whether they admit it or not, irrespective of the mindfuck that they're subjected to and that they believe. They are collaborators, and they're part of the problem. So the few of us who have come to understand otherwise and who are busy defending their communities and truly fighting their own oppression in the sense of Paulo Freire and others, then we have to stick together and not lose our energy and our effort by trying to accept to be brought into the fold. Because as soon as you start these crazy negotiations, as soon as you have these planning meetings where you're trying to come to some agreement that you'll do a demonstration over here, and if you want to call on us for help, we're here, but they don't really want your help because they don't see it as help, and so on and so on, it just becomes a total waste I think.
And what about the anarchist who denounce direct action? Because you make a clear distinction between anarchist and other tendencies like liberal, socialist,
yes,
progressist,
yes, well,
pacifist. But we saw also this year, particularly during the Olympics, anarchists denouncing direct action, and also before the G20 and some other situations.
Yes. Well, I think that the anarchists who do not understand the importance of direct action, and maybe I need to say a little bit about what I understand by direct action, what I mean by direct action, but the anarchists who don't understand the essential importance of direct action and of confrontation, in my book, cannot possibly be anarchists. Okay? So I believe that there is a group of so-called anarchists who have largely been co-opted and who have taken only one part of the anarchist ideals, which is the community building part, the egalitarian part, the idea that you need horizontal structures, that you have to be, you know, you cannot be gender biased and racist and so on. You have to remove all of those inequalities that come from different individuals. Those anarchists who concentrate and define themselves entirely in that way, to my sense, should not be called anarchists. They have been co-opted. Now, having said that, I want to add that I believe that community building and egalitarian treatment of our colleagues with which we are in solidarity is very important. It's essential, but it's not, it cannot on its own be the defining characteristic of what an anarchist is. An anarchist is someone who recognizes that hierarchy necessarily produces exploitation and injustice, and that therefore hierarchical systems must be fought, and they understand that this means confrontation, that this means taking down a structure and making that hierarchical pyramid flatter and as flat as possible, that you actually have to work at that. You cannot produce that result simply by going off and creating or having ideal relationships and an ideal isolated community in your own little group of friends. That's not being an anarchist. Well, okay, there have been, even throughout history, there have been anarchists who have tended to want to create idealistic segregated communities to defend themselves, but then they also defended those communities through direct action from mainstream society and so on. So that battle, that confrontation is essential. It's necessary. There's no way around that if you're going to call yourself an anarchist. That's my belief about anarchism, that one essential characteristic has to be confronting the dominant hierarchical system.
You always wanted to define more what is direct action for you?
Well, for me, direct action means that I'm using my body, my voice, and my influence in community and society, my own personal influence that I have, that direct action to me is using all of that. In other words, direct action is not primarily defined by the fact that you're using a brick or a stick or that you're using physical force. That's not, for me, the essential feature. The essential feature of direct action is the fact that as an individual, you're doing it. You're putting yourself at risk. You're participating as an individual. You're contributing to the confrontation, to the battle, to trying to fight this. You're willing as an individual to put yourself at risk with those beside you who are also willing to do the same. There might only be two others beside you. There might be more. And certainly you're going to continue to organize and to seek ways that these individuals who are committed to that can protect themselves and so on. Of course, that's part of it. But without the essential feature that is, as an individual, you're going to use your body, your voice, your influence, yourself as a person in part as in this battle. If there isn't that, then in my book, there's nothing. If you don't have that, there's nothing. Solidarity only makes sense between people who are fighting, who are willing individually to risk and to go to battle. That's the true nature of solidarity. anything else is just, you know, the word is so badly used in so many contexts. Like, often it simply means, among progressives, it simply means having the same opinion, progressive opinion as other people. You know, and they'll call that solidarity. That's meaningless to me, because opinion is not what produces change. Resistance, true resistance, is what produces change. So I have a fundamentally different belief about how societal improvement occurs than do progressives. And we have to recognize those fundamental differences, because if you have a different model about how societal change occurs, and I think progressives, their model is an illusion, a comfortable illusion that helps to justify that they're avoiding risk, whereas the model that I prefer is a realistic model that recognizes that I will be putting myself at risk. And I have to gauge that, I have to measure it, I have to continually evaluate it, and see what I can do with that. But I see clearly what the problem is, and I see the system as the enemy. I have to recognize it to be an enemy that will take my humanity away, that will violently oppress me in controlling me, in not allowing me to have political influence, and so on. So once I understand that, and I understand that I choose to fight it in order to liberate myself, in order, I fight my own oppression because I'm being stopped from being fully human and from having the full influence that I'm entitled to as a human being. As soon as I decide that I'm going to fight that, then I am also liberating myself. I'm learning as best I can the true nature of the world, and I'm learning about myself like I couldn't any other way. So I believe that liberating struggle, I guess what Paulo Freire called praxis, is also what produces self-knowledge and knowledge about the world outside of you. So those two types of knowledge come together, of course. So I think that's what it's about. I think people who understand that have to be clear what they're about, and have to be clear that, you know, there's this whole mass over here that haven't got a clue, that want to be in this illusion, and that will defend this illusion as a question of personal identity. They will defend it. So you can't really logically explain this to them, because it's deeply psychological. They've invested a lot in this illusion of pacifism, and the idea that your opinion's going to have an influence on government, and the idea that, you know, how the mainstream media portrays you is dreadfully important, because that's what will ultimately improve society, and so on. All these kinds of illusions, right? Now, I want to add on the question of mainstream media that how we are seen by mainstream society protects us to a large extent. I mean, there is some protection there that we need to use. For example, mainstream society still holds this myth that they are against murder, that they're against genocide. And because, even though they practice it and they support a system that practices it, that mythology is very strong in them. And so if you point out these discrepancies between things that might be happening to you and their myth about not committing murder and genocide and about being fair in society and so on, then that offers you some protection. So the anarchist uses this in society to some degree to get protection. So there are all kinds of methods, and that's all part of tactics and direct action and so on. So there is this complicated network of ideas and methods and connection to the mainstream society that's very real. But at the same time, I think we need a clear picture of the enemy versus the people who get it and who are on the side of fighting their own oppression. Because I believe Paulo Freire's position, which is you can only fight your own oppression. And if we all did that, the system would be transformed. Even if only one of us does that, the system is transformed. So, but that's all you can do. That's the best you can do. Paulo Freire insists on the fact that those inter-class crossings where you go and help someone else with their oppression, that those are extremely rare, that they're so rare it's not worth theorizing about. that is a fringe phenomenon that is incredibly rare. You know, for example, I met a terrorist one time who had traveled from Switzerland to El Salvador to be part of the civil war there, who actually fought on the front line. Well, that's an extraordinarily rare thing, and he made his home in El Salvador, and he's still there struggling to preserve the memory of that civil war and to improve society and so on. That is 1 in 100 million. So it's not worth building our theory of activism around these remarkable exceptions. Overall, you can only fight your own oppression, and you need to fight it from your position of power in society and have the most influence that you can from that position. That's what it's about. If we can spread that in all the work environments, at school, on the street, everywhere where people are, depending on their class and so on, you start where you're at, and you're in a particular class, and you participate in removing class structure, but from where you're at, by fighting your own oppression. Now, that's sort of, I'm starting to develop now sort of my theory of what is needed, some of the essential features that are required for any successful and true revolution. You know, I think that at times when societal changes were occurring, there was a significant number of actors who were resisting in a real way. They didn't just accept wage slavery. They didn't just accept the hierarchical structures and the control mechanisms that had been put in place. They were resisting them. They were fighting them. They were practicing sabotage. They were doing work to rule. They were developing schemes to get around what the bosses want and so on. And that was their mentality. And within that mentality, they could understand others resisting in the same way. And that's what gave strength to these large popular movements that could provide changes, because power understood that was the reality on the ground, that, you know, you couldn't fool people, and that, you know, they wanted this, they really wanted it, you know, and so on. So I think I've developed some of my ideas beyond the particular essay that you're asking me about, but I hope that it's helpful.
A lot of time we will see people doing direct action, not necessarily only against their own oppression, in solidarity with other direct actions, like by people fighting against their own oppression in other places, other countries. A lot of times we will see that. What do you think about that from your theory about fighting your own oppression?
Well, I agree with it and I support it, okay? You say a lot of times, from your perspective, from your experience, it's a lot of times, but it's actually a very small fringe phenomenon, right? And, for example, I made the comparison with this guerrilla fighter from Switzerland who came to El Salvador. Well, okay, 1 in 1 million. Well, the a lot of times that you're talking about, you know, the Black Bloc and others, and, for example, Aboriginal Solidarity, people who will actually go to the barricade and actually participate in defending and so on, that a lot of times is very few people in our society. And I celebrate those people, and I say that they're incredibly rare jewels that we should celebrate for being able to have that kind of sacrifice and being able to understand deeply as persons that the damage that's being done over here is being done to them as well. And they identify to the point where they can go onto the front line like that. So I'm totally in favor of it. But I just think that most people can immediately start to liberate themselves by fighting their own oppression, no matter where they are. As soon as you start to do that, it has an immediate impact. For example, I wrote an essay that was entitled G20 Toronto, Property Damage is a Good Thing. And in that essay, I explained that targeted property damage in this way, all the benefits of that, the immediate benefits in terms of resisting, and I explained the logic of why that was a good thing and how it's a direct expression using your body and yourself, and where you're actually doing it yourself, and you're having an immediate impact that actually is much greater than just breaking that window. There's a cascade effect of the impact of what you've done. So you're having a huge impact. For example, you're increasing the insurance cost of the corporation. You're damaging the image of the corporation. You're damaging their advertisement because it looks bad, the clients coming in. You're causing them to spend a lot more money on security. You're making it visible that you're resisting. Just that simple action by the person of targeted property damage has all these repercussions, an immediate real impact. Now imagine if everyone started doing that, or if more people, as soon as each time one more person starts to do it, you know, if it's one, two, it's double and so on, there's all that repercussion is multiplied by the number of people who are doing it. So that, I think, is highly effective and efficient activism. You know, we saw it in Argentina when the general population just went wild, just smashed everything that looked like a bank. Well, that made it really clear that the banks weren't not coming in and we're not going to start exploiting people anytime soon. And it allowed them to default on this extortion called their national debt. It allowed them to start reconstructing their economy as they intended to, as people, to have much more say, to throw out governments one after the other until they wanted to tolerate the particular one that was in there. I mean, once people decide that they're not going to take it anymore and they physically go in there and decide this is what I'm doing, it has an immediate and multiplied effect. That's effective activism. So I support that kind of direct action. I'm not against it. I'm just saying in broad terms here in our first world society, I think there's a lot of potential for rooting resistance and discovery of self and liberation that would alleviate a lot of our psychological ills, a lot of our health problems, a lot of the inhumanity that's taken away from us, not just the Black Bloc members, but professional workers, workers at all levels, cubicle workers, and so on. Everyone is suffering from this. You can tell from the amounts of pharmaceuticals that we consume and all the escapism that we practice and all the crazy mental imagery that we use to make sense of it all. You can tell that we're all suffering from this. So there's potential for sparks of resistance to grow in every work environment, in every school, at every level. So I am suggesting that every time that happens, just like every time you smash a window of a bank, that every time that happens in a work environment or at school, that is a real effect, and that's where we need to go.
Just thinking about the example that Goldell gave to me the last time I did an interview with, talking about like, oh, that was during the Oka crisis, when the people was fighting in Oka against the extension of the golf course, but so many other places in the same time in the country, people was doing direct action in support of Oka, but also in support of their own struggles. And that is probably one of the biggest struggles in Canada for a lot of years. So I think how we can think about create this momentum of our own struggles, but in sometimes having this support was not only a support for our own struggles, but a support for the struggles of people fighting in the same time for us and for them.
Well, yes, I understand what you're saying, but I would counter what you just said in the following way. I would say that that's not something you have to think about. You know, I'm inspired every time I hear about another struggle somewhere and about these direct actions. And it motivates me to fight harder from where I'm at in my particular environment and to create more links and to find others who are willing to fight. It motivates me automatically to do that. I don't need a big planning apparatus beyond my own community and so on. I hear about it. You know, indie media is wonderful for that and so on. But it's not like you have to have national conferences about how we're going to do that. These sparks arise naturally, and you push things as hard as you can to the extent that you feel oppressed and that you're willing to fight your own oppression, and they just go. And so these phenomena erupt and are spontaneous, and you don't need a theory to support that. You can theorize about it. You can do this kind of examination and have discussions. If it helps you in your practice, fine. But I don't think the activism should be about developing a theory that will tell you how to act in this way, if that makes sense.
You ask me what you will say to people on the upper class that they can do to support the struggles or to be in struggles. I will be interested to send you back the question.
What would I say to them? Well, I would, if I'm in contact with them. If I'm in, you know, if I'm not in their circles, if I'm not in their world, there's nothing I can say to them, right? But to the extent that I have contact with them and can meet them and so on, have influence, in other words, they care about what I think about them and so on, I can embarrass them and so on. If there's some linkage there, then I would say to them, depending on where I can see they're at, depending on what their psychology is, what arguments they're using to justify themselves and so on, I would say various things to them. For example, I could say to them, fuck you. You know, I could say to them, you know, you're totally grotesque in my eyes. You know, the rationale you've developed for yourself, for your privilege and how you're going to step on these people and exploit them is disgusting, and I'm disturbed by it. And I will expose you to the best of my ability. You know, I could say those things to them if I thought it was useful to say it to them, if, you know, in front of their friends to have some kind of repercussions or something, then I would do that. Or I could just simply expose them, try to put out press releases, put it on a blog that I know people will read or something like that, or that I know that their friends will read and so on. And so on and so on. So, this is a question of tactics, really. It's a question of, so it depends on circumstances. It depends on what you believe. It depends also the extent to which these particular upper class individuals are your oppressors. Okay? There is an example here in my particular case. I was fired from the University of Ottawa in, quite grotesque abuse of power, an illegitimate act. And I am exposing that and how it occurred, and I do it by various means. And a lot of that exposing has a significant impact. I can see the impact. I can measure it. I have been able to dramatically change the behaviors of the top people at that institution and put them in boxes often. And that helps students in their struggles and others who are oppressed by this institution and so on.
Do you think that Ayn Rand is a better person right now?
Not. Well, I think his behavior has significantly been changed. That's clear. I could give examples of that. So I don't know that I'm not in a position to know what a better person is, but at least he understands that there's a lot of things that he would do without thinking before, that there's no way he's going to go there. You know, he's going to be very careful.
You're not afraid that he will like evolve to give less legitimacy to people like you revolting against him?
No, I'm not afraid of all the ways that power schemes to keep power and to increase their power. I'm not afraid of that. That's part of how it is. We'll also evolve, and you know, we all just do the best we can. The important thing is that we're resisting, that we're actually doing it. I think that is what's important to me, because it gives meaning to my life to be liberated in this way and to find my place, my influence, and to find out who I am, what I stand for. So I'm going to keep doing it. I'm not going to be afraid of how the system's going to evolve to try and box me in more and stuff like that, you know. If you're afraid of those things, then you wouldn't do anything.